The Sanskrit language, whatever be its antiquity, is of a wonderful structure, more perfect than the Greek, more copious than the Latin, and more exquisitely refined than either, yet bearing to both of them a stronger affinity, both in the roots of verbs and the forms of grammar, than could possibly have been produced by accident. So strong, indeed, that no philologer could examine them all three without believing them to have sprung from some common source, which, perhaps, no longer exists. There is a similar reason, though not quite so forcible, for supposing that both the Gothic and the Celtic, though blended with a very different idiom, had the same origin with the Sanskrit, and the Old Persian might be added to the same family. William Jones. Welcome to this week's episode of Warfare, Advancement, and Revisionism. My name is Preston Floyd, and as always, I am your host. I'd like to thank everyone for joining me this week. I appreciate the support. If you're a newcomer, welcome in. Hope you'll go back and listen to our backlog of episodes. And I strongly do recommend you listening to last week's episode, especially because I've had to change up some plans. But for our returning listeners, thank you guys. As always, again, your support means the world. Now, just going to go ahead and start off by reminding everyone that there will be no new episode next week. I'll be traveling for Labor Day here in the U.S., so apologies for that, but I just won't be back in time to record regularly, and during the week I'm going to be too busy to record, you know, an episode. So today's goal was going to be focused on the Proto-Indo-European language, theories about it, and the concepts, history, and kind of go from there. However, I got a good amount of feedback on the last episode, and I wanted to go over that because I thought it was good, and I like the feedback. I love hearing from people, and it's part of the reason I do the show. So I am going to include a timestamp to jump towards the actual Proto-Indo-European stuff, but they may not be that much of it because there's a lot of feedback I got. So I'm going to try to get through as quick as I can. But this, what I wanted to do on this episode might be a little bit shorter. So we're going to have basically another part for that. So we'll play it by ear, see what it takes in terms of timing, and then we'll go from there. At the very least, I'm going to go into the history of the concept and how that has evolved over time and, you know, kind of a popular understandings about that. For now, though, let's jump to the feedback that I receive. First, thank you to Rob for sending me that article on cattle breeds. It was informative, and it does answer my question on the number of horse breeds versus cattle breeds versus sheep and all that other kind of stuff. It does look like cattle breeds do outnumber horse breeds by quite a large margin. Apparently, cattle have over 1,000 recognized breeds. Horse breed numbers are debated, but most of the ones I saw numbered them between 350 and 600, and then sheep and goats have around 300 to 400 or so each. Though again, some of that's debated as well, and you know, upon really deep reflection about it, the cattle number makes sense. There is a definitive evidence of two separate domestication events when it comes to cattle, and of two domestication events of two different subspecies. And then, you know, who knows how many instances of crossbreeding between those two strains, as well as other wild boss there were. So there is a lot more genetic diversity to select and breed from than there is for horses. So, you know, that makes sense. So again, thank you, Rob, for sending me that information. And that reminded me, as I was, you know, kind of making my notes about Rob's information, it also reminded me of a clarification that I wanted to bring up in regard to the Tarpan horse. So as I mentioned, Przewalski horses were a true undomesticated strain of equid. The case of the Tarpan is much murkier. There is debate if they were descendants of actual wild horses that were never domesticated, or if they were descendants of an earlier breed or strain of domesticated stocks that then became wild. or if they were a mix of wild horses and feral domesticated horses. And I also forgot to mention that there were attempts by some breeders, and they may still be ongoing, I'm not sure, but to create a breed from modern domesticated horses to resemble what the Trapan horse looked like. This is known as backbreeding. You may remember several months ago, there were several articles saying they resurrected the dire wolf, when in actuality, what they did, they just created a breed to resemble some aspects of direwolf morphology. They were not the actual size of direwolves, and they were not genetically direwolves. They were just designed to look like what we believed a direwolf to have looked like, or at the very least, resemble the direwolves in Game of Thrones. because, of course, modern wolves are not descended from direwolves. Direwolves were a separate species of wolf that died out and did not contribute in any way to the ancestor populations of our dogs or of modern day wolves. Now, for the second bit of feedback I got via a listener, they didn't leave a name, and I don't want to leak their email account, but I did respond to the person directly, so you know who you are, and I did, again, I thank you for reaching out to me. They wanted me to elaborate on horse digging into the snow for fodder and cattle and sheep not doing that because he personally had seen cows eat off the ground during the snow. He mentioned he grew up in Ohio and saw cows on nearby farms in winter eating in the snow. Now, he did say that it was never too deep when he saw this, and he wanted to know how deep it is too deep for cows to eat in the snow. Now, firstly, I kind of just simplified things, and I maybe should have elaborated more at the time, but that's what we're going to do now. But first and foremost, I am not a farmer and never have been. And while I do have some extended family and I have friends with, family who have own farmland, most of them were not primarily livestock farms. Plus, where we live, you don't really have to worry about snow. So I have to learn from what I've read and heard people talk about. Firstly, I should have, again, phrased myself better and been a little clearer. Cattle and sheep and goats can dig with their hooves, but they are not as skilled at it as horses. And in snow, most cattle breeds prefer to use their snouts or horns to dig. Now, how viable is this grazing for a ruminant, which, for those that don't know, a ruminant is an animal with four stomachs, or that's how it's popularly understood, but they're not really four stomachs. It's one big stomach with four separate chambers, and that includes cows, sheep, goats. Horses are not ruminants. They just have the one chambered stomach. Well, firstly, how much snow is on the ground? Obviously, a dusting won't cause problems. But what if you were to get up to a quarter inch or more? Well, that depends on what type of snow it is. And in that case, it might be a problem. If it's freshly fallen and fluffy, probably won't be too much of an issue until you start getting to about a foot or more. But if it's been crushed and compacted, and then you get heavier, wetter snow fall on top of that, and you have ice form, then you might start experiencing issues with as little as an inch or two of snow. At that point, once you start brushing your hand through it, like if you just ran your hand through it, like at a speed to kind of clear it away, your hand might get cuts or nicks. The same thing is true for, animals, except obviously they don't have hands. They're going to cut up their faces and in some cases, even their legs. Also, cows are fairly large, of course, and one of their preferred methods of clearing snow is to follow behind a couple of herd members as they run through the snow. And then they eat the food exposed by their tracks, which if you've gotten enough cattle and the ground isn't frozen, they can really tear up your land and fields, which, you know, if you practice agriculture, that might be a problem later. But if it's just over, you know, open terrain, wild grass, you know, you probably don't care about it too much. Plus, you know, the display sow is going to be plowed into areas that they haven't run through. And if the snow is continuing to fall and it freezes over again, it's going to become compacted and it's going to become harder. And then it's going to become kind of an icy rock. And running through that may also cause injuries to their legs or their quarters. So with more snow, every bite your animal needs to take requires them to work harder, risk these small cuts or other injuries which could become infected. And of course, this is doubly true for sheep and goats because they're smaller and they have to work harder than cows. Another variable in all this is what type of forage is available. In areas where agriculture was practiced, there might be enough left on the ground in the field, you know, from when you've done your harvest, for them to gorge on that for a bit. But if it is just wild grass, it might not be worth the time, the risk of injuries, or the calories your animal is burning for them to let them dig through all that. It's better for them to be corralled for long periods of time and fed fodder until you need to move your herds again. Or in some cases, have your horses clear the snow and keep them moving while you then lead your other animals where your horses have kind of trod. Your horses don't need as much food as cattle. So, you know, you can kind of keep them moving while they clear kind of an area and then move your cattle behind them at a slower pace. Both animals eat something like 2-3% of their body weight a day if they can. But you got to remember, these early horses never got much more than like 650 pounds, which is like 300 kilograms. Today, modern horses can get up to 1,000 pounds or like 450 kilograms. Because you got to keep in mind, a lot of these early herding communities that we've been discussing have multiple types of animals, and they always needed to make a cost-benefit judgment on how to keep as many of their animals as hale and hearty as possible. And of course, also, you know, some breeds just deal better with the cold and snow than others. Though again, how much breed specialization there is at the time frames we've been covering, it's kind of hard to say. So just to try and simplify all that, horses can forage better than cows and other ruminants. Though, of course, you know, their digestive system isn't as tough, so they really just need, you know, they can really only handle grass, you know, cows and stuff, you know, probably a little bit wider variety of options for them. So horses are better adapted to the steppe, and you can see signs of this in their modern descendants. So, you know, this is an area that a horse is designed to live in. Cows, sheep, goats, probably not as much. You know, that's kind of just kind of a rough over. And ideally for cows, you don't want them to have to, you know, move around much in the winter than you need them to. A lot of modern farms especially, they use the winter to kind of help bulk up their cows. They don't need to be outside as much. They don't need to, you know, they won't exercise as much. If you're feeding them, I mean, you don't have to keep them moving necessarily to find food. If you have enough fodder, you can just kind of keep them, you know, in a general area, feed them, fatten them up, get them ready for, you know, maybe a midwinter harvest or or slaughter. Or, you know, once winter is over, you have a big celebratory feast. You get rid of some of your older, fatter cows. And then you get the younger crowd in there ready to, you know, repopulate your herd, that kind of thing. Anyway, so I hope I cleared that up. I hope you found that as interesting as I did to learn and talk about it. All right, so with all of that out of the way, let's go ahead and start our study of Proto-Indo-European. And we're going to cover, at least for this episode, we're going to cover the history of the origins of the theory. Now, if you're to Google the tablet, most searches are going to point you towards a Welshman, Sir William Jones, as being the first proponent of the theory. And indeed, in some extreme examples, they'll list him as one of the early forefathers of comparative linguistics. Now, that's a very simple, you know, easy way to look at it. And William Jones certainly had a lot of influence on the broader recognition, at least in the English-speaking world, on the theory. But he was not actually the oldest proponent of this, at least not exactly. But we'll go into a little bit more detail on that. But firstly, let's talk about Sir William Jones. Jones was born in September 1746. His father, also William Jones, was from Anglesey. And his father was actually a very famous mathematician. He is the one that introduced the pi symbol, using the Greek letter pi to symbolize the irrational number pi. And his son, while not as mathematically gifted, was very much kind of a linguistic prodigy. In addition to English and Welsh, he knew Greek, Latin, Persian, Arabic, Hebrew, and he even learned a little bit about Chinese characters, though how fluent he was in Chinese, I'm not 100% sure. The sources on that are kind of mixed. He graduated from Oxford around, I think he was around 22, 21 years old, and he got his Master of the Arts in 1773. He did this while he was also studying the law, and because he was a poor college student, he was having to serve as a tutor for, you know, a lord or a lord's son, as well as doing freelance translation work. In fact, I saw, and I only saw this on Wikipedia, so I don't know how true it is, but he translated a French translation of the History of Nader Shah, which was written by a Persian initially. So I do have to wonder, you know, how much he was able to use his knowledge of both languages in that translation, or if he just worked directly from the French. But he actually did that at the request of the King Christian VII of Denmark. Now, in 1783, he moved to parts of British India. I think Calcutta is where he initially was. And while there, one of his chief jobs was to kind of come up with a legal code that was compatible with, he came up with a couple of legal codes, one for Hindu, one for Muslim, and trying to, you know, integrate that into the local British administration of the region. And while there, he learned Sanskrit. He learned about Hindu philosophy. He read the Vedas from locals there. And while doing this, he eventually came up with a theory, and he published these as letters over a couple of years, but they were all kind of written around the same time, and he kind of sent them out to the, you know, Asiatic societies in Europe as, you know, kind of in waves, essentially. But they were all written kind of in concert with each other. His theory was published in, I think it's the third anniversary discourse. So he wrote it in 1786, his third anniversary of being stationed in Calcutta. And in that, he kind of proposed a proto-language that combined Sanskrit, Iranian, Greek, Latin, Germanic, and Celtic. Now, those are the ones that most Indo-European scholars would agree he got right. However, he also included others that were, you know, that should have been in, or he included ones that should not have been there, and also kept some languages out that should have been in his theory. He specifically includes Egyptian, Japanese, and Chinese, interestingly enough, and he did not include the Hindustani and Slavic languages. So, kind of haphazard. He's also one of the big, originating points of the Aryan invasion theory of India, which we're going to go into that a lot later. But by and large, you know, his specific theory has pretty much been disproven, both linguistically and when it comes to the Aryan invasion theory, historically. Now, one of the reasons Jones is so widely known, or at least recognized by, you know, a lot of people that are not linguists, kind of as the originator of this theory, is that he was very good at, you know, explaining himself, at least, again, to the English-speaking world. And his works were very influential. They inspired a lot of the Romantic poets of the day to kind of couch their work in kind of these Orientalist themes and terminology. But he's not the first person to, you know, see a link between these languages. And he's not the, you know, the father of linguistics. I mean, if you want to go back far enough, at least when it comes to, you know, the Indo-European languages, you have people who've been writing far earlier than him that have noted the similarities between these various subfamilies of Indo-European languages. You have another Welshman, Giraldus Cambrensis, or as he's otherwise known, Gerald of Wells. He wrote in 1194 about connections between Welsh and Irish, and Welsh and the Germanic languages, and Welsh and Latin. Dante, the famous poet Dante, he wrote in 1305. He recognized the Romance languages as all being descended from Latin, but he also noted similarities between Germanic languages and these Romance languages. There's plenty of others, but those are just the two that, you know, I know off the top of my head, and I remember from reading a paper about this. And he was not the first to notice the similarities between Sanskrit, Greek, and Latin. That had been noticed, you know, as soon as Europeans were coming in contact with India directly. Thomas Stevens in the 1480s noticed it. And then also, you had, I think it was an Italian, Sassetti. He also wrote that in the 1580s. And then you have a couple of French guys and some Germans as well. So he was not, he's not the first person, to notice this. There were quite a few scholars ahead of Jones, that had noted that relationship. And, you know, Jones was a man of his time. He's trying to relate what he had noticed with, you know, his own understanding of the world, with biblical history, and he's trying to tie all these threads together. And, you know, of course he made mistakes because, you know, he's coming from, you know, some false assumptions or some popular European Orientalist assumptions that were just, you know, wrong. But that being said, you know, I don't want to tear the guy down too much. Again, he was very influential in, you know, making the theory popular in, you know, in, again, at the very least, the English-speaking world, but in other parts of Europe as well. And that quote I read, you know, that one gets taken out of context a lot. He wasn't trying to make this grand statement about how great Sanskrit was. He's just talking about in terms of, you know, how it's different from Greek and Latin. I'd recommend reading the whole thing. You can find it online. And if you're interested in learning more about, like, you know, some of his forebears in that and some of the other, you know, more recent attempts of people trying to show, you know, he wasn't really that important to comparative linguistics. There's a very good article I read. It's not an article. It's an actual paper. It's by Lyle Campbell from the University of Canterbury in New Zealand. It's called Why Sir William Jones Got It All Wrong, or Jones's Role in How to Establish Language Families. His is more of a takedown on, like, how Jones came up with his theory. And that's not how Jones's, like, methodology is not how modern linguists determine language and all that other kind of stuff. But he is a very important, again, in the English-speaking world of making the theory more widely recognized in the popular imagination, which in some cases, you know, there are problems with that, but it's also, you know, if it's not in the popular imagination, No one outside of academics is really going to care about it, in my opinion. So I don't want to tear William Jones down too much. He's a Welshman. Good, my countryman. Shouts out to anyone that recognizes the Shakespeare reference there. Let me know what play that's from if you know it. But as time goes on, other scholars, you know, they are all, again, they're working not just from Jones's work, but other authors as well as their own. And of course, as more of India opens up to Europeans and other parts of the world opens up to Europeans, over the 18th and 19th and into the early 20th century, you do get linguistics establishes a discipline, and then you get comparative linguistics, and you know, people work on the theory of Proto-Indo-European, which is again the concept that the languages of Europe, the languages of India, and the areas in between at one point had a common ancestor. And that's kind of how the theory at least first starts. You have the linguistics reconstruction. You say, okay, which language do we have a record of being spoken? However it is, what words meant what? What do they mean today? How did they come into, and when did they come into use in these various languages? And that's something, you know, that has gone back and forth for a long time. Then in the kind of the mid-20th to today, you begin to have archaeological evidence. You say, okay, what are these? What are we finding? Where are we finding these? The written evidence for this. Where can we see, you know, changes over time in written language? What's the oldest writing we can find, like physically find, not just read about, but actually put our hands on? Obviously, there's a limit to how far back the written language goes, so there are problems. But then you also find other archaeological things that might hint at the popular theory that the Indo-European languages were carried in these waves of migrations and invasions. We'll talk about that in detail probably in the next episode. And then as you get into the late 20th, early 21st century, you now have genetic data to go on. And you can kind of see, well, is there evidence of these, you know, migrations happening in terms of population? Are there people from one area to another? If so, when did this happen? And DNA has been very important in tweaking a lot of the assumptions that people have had, or in some cases, completely deleting assumptions, or in other cases, adding more nuance, or, allowing more accurate models to be presented. So that is kind of, you have the theory develop in waves. Originally, it's just linguistics reconstruction. Then you have linguistics mixed with archaeological evidence. And now you have all three. You have linguistic, archaeological, and genetic. And I should say that even with all of these new methods being introduced, they have cleared up nothing. Well, they've cleared up some stuff. But by and large, it's still a field fraught with debate, and in some cases, controversy. And we'll go into some of the controversies later, why those happened. But we'll also do, some of the more archaeological focused things, specifically the three main theories that exist today on the Proto-Indo-European origin. And I'll go ahead and mention them this week to kind of whet your appetite for the next couple of episodes. And I'm only going to be going over primarily the very widely accepted ones. There are, of course, other theories, some with little to no evidence, some of which are just, either fringe or in some cases just straight up crackpot stuff, or not crackpot, but today are, you know, there's just no evidence to support them, so they've either fallen out of use or belief, or that they are, you know, only held on to by a very small number through, you know, for various reasons, including, you know, nationalism, ethnic pride, that sort of thing. But essentially, the three primary hypotheses are, there's the steppe hypothesis, there's the Anatolian hypothesis, as well as the southern hypothesis, also known as the Armenian hypothesis, though, again, the southern hypothesis has a lot more nuance to it. Some people, you know, Armenian was the initial one, but since then, some of the Armenian people that, or some of the people who believed in the Armenian hypothesis, kind of moved that around. It's not specifically Armenia, but we'll get into all that next time. But I do think that this is kind of a good place to stop. We're at a nice 30 minutes, and you know, we did kind of get through the feedback and the other stuff. Again, I wasn't planning on doing as much feedback, but the last episode got a very big response, so I'm very pleased. But if you enjoyed this week's episode, please like, rate 5 stars, download, subscribe, whatever your platform asks you to do to support your podcaster, I please ask you to do that. If you have any questions, comments, constructive criticism, please let me know. You can reach me via email at waradrevpod@gmail.com. You can contact me via direct message on X/Twitter, or you can comment on the YouTube version of the video, and I'll be glad to respond there if I can. Otherwise, I'll just leave a like or a heart or whatever there just to let you know that I've seen it. But yeah, I hope you've enjoyed. And I hope you will be back next time. Also, yeah, I turned off the mid ads, the mid-roll ads on RSS, but they still ran. So I don't know what's going on with that. So I've put in a ticket. It might be something that they say you can turn off, but then that button doesn't work yet. I don't know. I don't want to disable ads completely. I'm going to, again, I've kind of letting it play through this month to kind of see what I'm at. Yeah. So, apologies for that. Also, no word back on the theme song. I'm still trying to find something that I like that I kind of think fits in with the show that is open source or, you know, free to use. Still not finding something that I quite enjoy. If you're subscribed on YouTube, thank you. We're at 335, I think, today. I do live stream there, so you're welcome to come by if you see I'm live and say hey in chat, and you can ask questions there. Don't try to send me any links or anything in YouTube, though. In the chat, they don't work. YouTube doesn't like you doing that. So if you want to send me a link to something, I do recommend you come and sending something either through email or through X or Twitter. But I hope you all have a good rest of your day and week from whenever you're listening to this. And if you're here in the U.S., have a great Labor Day. I know I'm going to be partaking in the return of college football. I already partook in week 0. It was an incredible game. I don't know if it was incredible, but it was a very fun game. Kansas State, Iowa State, taking place in Ireland. You all have a good one. I'll see everyone next time. Peace.